In academic biblical studies, there is a position which is dominant. I'd say it's almost the exclusive position in academia. And it is called either biblical criticism or the documentary hypothesis of the Bible. What I want to do this evening is introduce you, if you haven't heard of it, to this idea, explain to you what its proponents count as the evidence in favor of the idea, and then to indicate to you some of its chief weaknesses, and in the course of so doing I will have some comments to make on archaeology, though that is not the main focus of this evening's discussion. The hypothesis, the documentary hypothesis, says that our Torah, the so-called five books of Moses, are really compiled from fragments, independent fragments of text. These fragments composed at different times by different people, under different local circumstances. The authors are members of different religious groups, although there is obviously some similarities between them, but there are also some differences between them. And at some point in history, someone called the editor put all these fragments together into one text, the text that we mistakenly call the five books of Moses, since, according to this hypothesis, Moses certainly didn't compose these five books as we have them. And then it will be an open question whether there was such a person as Moses or wasn't such a person as Moses. But that's the idea. Our five books is a compilation, an accumulation of originally independent fragments of text, stitched together by an editor, maybe under pressure, we'll modify that a little bit later, but take it that way for now, an editor into the text that we all know and call the five books of Moses. Indeed, it's not a question of splitting up the books, because within books, even within chapters or within single stories, biblical critics discern elements of different texts. In fact, biblical criticism started with the book of Genesis alone and claimed to discover two or more different authors within the single book of Genesis. It's not a question of saying someone wrote Genesis, somebody else wrote Exodus. It's much more finely cut than that. The flood story itself may have two or three different authors whose materials were woven together by the editor. Now, what would lead a group of people, a school of thought, to take such a position? There are four main categories of evidence. The first, most important, the one upon which the biblical critics lay the heaviest store, is variations in literary style. If you look carefully at the biblical text, you will see considerable variations of style. Sometimes matters of grammar or word order or word usage. Sometimes fundamentally crucial matters like the names of God. And the thought is, variations of literary style usually indicate different authorship. Different authors have different styles. Especially when it comes to fundamental matters like the names of God. After all, each name of God embodies some conception, some characteristic, some quality that God possesses. And it is assumed that different communities picture God in different ways. Each community's name for God will express its conception of God's fundamental nature. So, we will expect that different communities will have different names. If you find one text with variation in names, that's an indication that the one text isn't really one text, but rather it's fragments woven together from different communities, each community possessing its own conception, its own name, and woven together by a later editor. You have variations in verbs and nouns and adjectives that one would expect belong to different dialects. For example, in Hebrew, the verb yalad means to give birth to. Strictly speaking, the subject of that verb ought to be a woman. Women give birth, men don't give birth. Sometimes men are described by the verb horid. Horid is a causative form which means to cause to give birth. That one can understand readily. In some places, the verb yalad is also used for men, which means you're stretching it from its basic meaning and applying it sort of in an extended version to men. Now you can easily imagine that one author will use the extended form of yalad and another author will not use the extended form of yalad. So when you have yalad for a man, it'll be one author, and holid for a man, it'll be a different author. How do you write numbers? Is it 120 and 7, or 7, 20, and 100, or 7 and 20 and 100, or you find sometimes one way, sometimes the other way. Presumption is that each normal person has one way of writing numbers. If you find a variation of ways of writing numbers, so then it must be that there were different people who were writing those numbers. That's one category of evidence. This is what really started the investigation in the 1880s. Wellhausen and Company. Secondly, you have contradictions. There are, if the text is read simply and literally, there are blatant contradictions between different passages. The natural thought is that an author, if he can help it, doesn't contradict himself. So if there are pretty obvious, blatant contradictions, that doesn't represent the work of one author. It represents different fragments written by different authors, which are then put together later by the editor. Then you have redundancies. You have laws appearing more than once. Stories appearing, well, not word for word, but close enough in general theme and general moral to be understood as variations on the same story. occurring twice or three times. And again, the thought is that a person doesn't just multiply material for no reason, unless it's being paid by the word. And so, with the obvious redundancies, they must have come from different fragments, written by different authors. And then the editor sewed it all together, keeping the redundancies in. Perhaps the editor was intent on pleasing all the groups, and therefore left each group's contribution in intact, even though the resulting text has contradictions in it and redundancies in it, but if you leave something out belonging to one group, maybe that group won't accept the resulting edited text, and you want to have as wide an impact as possible. The fourth category of evidence that they cite is the appropriateness of certain passages to certain historical periods in which social conditions make these passages especially relevant. You have in Deuteronomy the laws of kings. Now, for a long period of time, the Jewish people didn't have a king. It was a loose confederation of tribes. And only later was it unified under the central authority of a single king. The thought goes, what do you need laws of a king in a society that doesn't have a king? But when you are trying to organize a society under a king, then it's reasonable to formulate the laws of how kings are supposed to behave. And so we could trace the composition of that part of Deuteronomy to the time of King David, who unified the whole of the Jewish people under one authority. And then we would have an indication of when and why that particular passage was written. The laws of the priests will represent a period in which there's a struggle for power, where the priests want to accumulate a certain amount of power. And so those laws come into being as a background for justifying their power. And these will be different periods. And so you have different authors at different periods responsible for different passages of the text. These are the four basic categories of evidence which have led people to accept the documentary hypothesis. Now, I want to start with a fundamental reflection of logic. Which has to do with all inquiry. It has nothing to do particularly with biblical criticism. You have a hypothesis, and someone presents evidence that the hypothesis is true. How do you assess, evaluate the evidence? You must formulate the competitors to the hypothesis under consideration and ask, when the evidence is presented, does the evidence favor the hypothesis under consideration over its competitors or not? There is no such thing as evidence for a hypothesis in isolation. This has been demonstrated by people in probability theory. The first question to ask is, we're considering hypothesis. We want to know whether it's acceptable or unacceptable. And we're considering the evidence in favor. Ask yourself, what are its competitors? And then check how the evidence discriminates between the hypothesis and its competitors. So let's think. The hypothesis we are considering is multiple human authorship. Multiple human authorship. What competitors are relevant? With respect to what competitors should we evaluate the evidence? If I put it that way, multiple human authorship, and you're objective about it, two competitors ought to spring to mind. One possible competitor is single human authorship. Rather than there being many people who wrote it at different times and places, there's one person who wrote the whole thing. That's one competing hypothesis. The other one is, can you hear the chorus? No, I wouldn't say that. Not academia. God. That's another competing hypothesis. Right? Single divine authorship. So really we have three hypotheses on the table. The documentary hypothesis, which is multiple human, single human, and divine authorship. Now, let's just run through the evidence and ask, if it's presented in favor of multiple human, what does it count against? What is it relevant against? What I want to show you is that the evidence is relevant against only single human authorship. It's not relevant against divine authorship. And therefore, it only supports the documentary hypothesis in one competition, does not support it in the other competition. So here's what I want to show you. The four categories of evidence we mentioned, variations in style, contradictions, redundancies, and local circumstances, are relevant in comparing many human authors with one human author, but not relevant in comparing many human authors with divine authors. Why? Because the key premise in the whole of the documentary hypothesis is that the whole hypothesis is based on understanding human psychology. All of the argumentation makes essential appeal to human psychology. If you don't make common assumptions about human psychology, the argument doesn't get off the ground. Let's go back through the evidence and go through the argumentation again. And listen to how it goes. Variations in style means multiple authors. Why? Because, as we know, authors have their own styles. What kind of authors? People. People whose books we've read. Modern people, ancient people, it seems that people have different styles. And each person has a roughly consistent style. That's the way it seems. We'll question that in a while, but this is the way their argument goes. So, if I have a document with widely varying styles, and I know that human authors, typically have a pretty uniform style, and I ask myself, so who wrote this book? Many people or one person, knowing what I know about human authors, I could suspect that many people authored it. It goes back to fragments of many different authors, because people typically have a pretty homogenous style, and this is a very heterogeneous book. All that is based on what I know about human authorship, about how human beings write books. Suppose I try to use this very evidence against divine authorship. Gosh, there are lots of variations in style. So God couldn't have written. Why? Well, you understand, I have 27 volumes at home that God wrote, and I've studied them, and God has a style, you see. I know God's style, so as a literary critic, I can tell you that God didn't write this book, I compare with all the other books that he wrote, right? Not really, because according to the critic, we don't have any books that God wrote. How do we know how God would write a book? How do we know whether he would use one style or several styles, one name for himself or several names for himself, whatever he's going to have to go on? I can't use human psychology in assessing how God would write a book. So the evidence here isn't relevant to the question of divine authorship. It's only relevant to deciding between multiple human authorship and single human authorship. But when you raise the question of divine authorship, the evidence just isn't relevant. It tells me nothing at all. Let's take contradictions. We say, if there are contradictions, it probably wasn't written by one author. Why? Because people, we know, typically don't want to contradict themselves. If the contradiction is open, obvious, blatant, one suspects that one person didn't write it. Because we know how people write. We know why people write. So if you ask me, is it many people or one person? I look at the contradiction, I say, not likely it's one person. One person wouldn't do that. Because I know people. I know how people act. I know what their purposes are. So contradictions count in favor of many human authors against one human author. But now let's try it on God. Oh, and it couldn't be God because there's a contradiction. Right. And we know that God wouldn't contradict himself, of course. And how do we know that?
I've known God for a long time. Listen, and in all my experience with God, he's never contradicted himself. How do I know what God will do? How can contradictions be evidence that God didn't write it? Redundancy is the same thing. Human beings don't put the same material in twice. It's a waste of time and effort. Ink, parchment. Paid more money to describe. So, unless you can discover some reason for repeating it, like poetry or something, you assume that a person wouldn't repeat himself that way. So if you have a text in which there are many repeats, it makes sense to think that maybe it's several authors, each of whom wrote his work in isolation, and somebody edited and put it all together. That makes sense. But now try it on God. Since there are repetitions in the text, therefore it's evidence against God writing. Because everybody knows that God wouldn't write the same thing twice. How do we know that? On what grounds do we assume God wouldn't write things over and over again? Fourth category. Conditions of composition. You're writing the laws of Kings. When would the laws of Kings be written? When kings become something prominent in the society. When will the laws of Kohanim, priests, be written? When priests become prominent in the society. So, one says, the time at which the kings became prominent and the times at which the priests became prominent were separated by 100 years. Obviously, it wasn't the same person. It must have been one person at the time of kings, another person at the time of priests. So that means there were two human authors rather than one human author. Now let's try to use that evidence against God. You have laws of kings, laws of priests, and he became prominent in society at different times. Therefore, God couldn't have written it. How does the conclusion follow? Talking about God now. Couldn't God write it 400 years before it was relevant? God isn't limited in that way. He doesn't have to wait for the thing to become relevant to write it. He can write it beforehand. So the first point to make is that the evidence isn't even relevant to the question of divine authorship. And the academic tragedy is this. The poor, unsuspecting student goes into the class, biblical criticism, his teacher's a PhD, written papers and books, obviously a scholar, and obviously objective, and presents to him this vast array of evidence in favor of the documentary hypothesis. And the poor student walks out at the end of the semester and says, the scientific biblical criticism has proven that God didn't write the book. When this elementary logical reflection could show that the question of divine authorship hadn't been addressed, it's simply been assumed on day minus one before he walked in that God isn't in question. And therefore you're only talking about human authorship. And therefore, the only alternatives that are really relevant are multiple human authorship and single human authorship. And all the evidence is presented to discriminate only between those alternatives. And the question of divine authorship had never even been addressed. That's point number one. Any question?
With contradictions, I can see the argument with literary styling, with redundancy. But with contradictions, I mean, what would be the point of God writing in two different places in the text, two contradicting things? I mean, everything within the Torah text, or we assume that there's some point to it, but with criticism, what will be the point of
it? It's an interesting question, but I want to point out, before I offer an answer, exactly how this question is or is not related to the position I'm taking. Are there outstanding questions in Shakespeare scholarship? Questions of why he put this character in this particular play, or why he put that speech in that act, and so on and so on. Does anyone suspect that if we can't answer why Shakespeare did it, then maybe somebody else wrote it? Or maybe it was just an accident that he quoted it over? Or maybe he copied it from the milkmaid? Or we expect, even when we know the author, that there will be questions about the work that we can't answer. If I can't answer you, suppose I say, I don't know why God put in contradictions. Is that then evidence that God didn't write it? It doesn't rehabilitate the evidence one whit. On the contrary, my whole argument is that we know so little about God, we don't know what to expect. Now you ask, well, if God wrote it, why did he do it? My answer could be, we know so little about him, we don't know why he did it. There's certainly not evidence against his writing it, that I don't know why he wrote it. It's not evidence in any other case to such a conclusion either. But the truth is that we do have many considerations, one of the largest of which is that the text always was accompanied by an oral supplement, and with the oral supplement, these contradictions are explained, analyzed, and applied. And in this way, you can see, this is one of the many ways you can see, that the written text needs an oral supplement, because written standing alone, it's hard to understand. So if you want a kind of explanation, I can offer it to you. As a logician, it's important for me to know that I don't have to explain it. It doesn't. My inability to explain it would not reduce the position, would not attack the position that I'm taking, that the evidence that they present is not relevant to the question of divine knowledge. Yeah?
This is another thing. Are you going to mention in this year any of those contradictions that
Jay Bible Christ, like you mentioned, the
most significant ones?
Well, not unless I have extra time, which doesn't look like I'm going to have. Now, here's another consideration, which I think is,
Are you saying the encounter expects the work of God to be at least perfect according to human terms? And beyond? Because if there are contradictions, maybe you would try not to contradict himself. So if we expect God to be beyond us, we for sure at least would contradict himself.
So I think that that form of inference would be rejected altogether. We don't expect God to agree fully with any of our categories. To be beyond us will mean not just to have everything we have and have more, but to have everything we have better. And to have it better may mean to have it in a way that is different and contradictory to what we do. Why should
the contradiction?
On the contrary, we certainly do not expect to be able to appreciate everything that God does. That would reduce God to our level. We expect many things that God does to be to us incomprehensible. Just as when I read Einstein's original papers, I don't expect to understand all of it, because he was a lot smarter than I am. Now, God, whose capacities are really infinite, I certainly don't expect to understand everything that he does. I say, well, on the contrary, if I could, then that would really be anthropomorphism in a very, very brutal sense. Now, let's speak for a moment about this editor. Here's the picture. You have 3, 4, 5, 8, 10, depending upon which biblical critic you like. There's JEPD, then there's J1, J2, and J3, E1 and E2 and E3. So you have also as many authors as you like. Each author belongs to a different community, expressing its point of view and its oral or somewhat written history of its group. And then you have the editor. The editor takes all these fragments together, combines them in a particular order, particular form, and then all the groups accept it. That means to say that each group has to accept a large body of material that is foreign to its group. Of course, its contribution is still there. That's nice. But then there's a lot of material that wasn't there at the beginning, and if all the groups accept this text as the official text, and the groups coalesce into one body, all revering the same text. Okay? Now, there isn't the slightest historical trace of this event. Not the slightest historical trace. Nowhere is such an event mentioned, alluded to, celebrated in poetry, a song. It didn't cause a civil war. There aren't holdout groups that never accepted it and remained with their fragments. There isn't a clue as to who did this. I suggest to you that that's pretty amazing. One of the candidates for the editor is Ezra. Now, Ezra lives at a time when the majority of the Jewish population lives in Babylon. There's a small Jewish settlement in the land of Israel, and that's where he is. He has a sizable Jewish community in Alexandria, Egypt, and there are smaller communities scattered in other places. We have to imagine that there is no five books of Moses. It doesn't exist. Just fragments exist. Now, Ezra, rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem and having central authority, gathers together the fragments, edits them into a single text, sends the text out to Babylon, to Alexandria, to other places. Everybody embraces the text, gives up their old text, adapts to new laws, new stories, new morals, new names of God, and there isn't a trace of this in any historical reference anywhere. I suggest to you that this is incredible in the nasty sense of non-credible. An event like this ought to have left its mark, either in terrible friction — we have records as to who invented the laws of washing your hands, but no records as to who unified the Bible. That's just elite, eclipsed from Jewish history. No records of debate, discussion, refusal, no celebration of the editor, no myth about how he was inspired by God or he was a great prophet and brought unity to the people. Nothing. I think that makes the entire hypothesis extremely difficult to accept. And there's another problem with the editor. Casuto points this out. You have the names of God, and there are variations in the names of God. Several names of God are used. The thought is, a passage in which one name is used is authored by the person in the community that used that name. The J name, the Yud and the Hay and the Vav and the Hay is called the J name. Elohim is called the E name. Two communities, two authors using two different names of God. But there's a difficulty. You can hardly find a single passage of any appreciable length that has only one name of God. Usually, even if it's a basically E passage, it's 90% E, but then there are a few J's scattered in. Or it could be 85% J, but there are 15% E scattered in. How could that happen? Why would that happen? It's not credible to say that it's amalgamating a J text and an E text, because the 10% J and the 90% E, the 10% J can't stand on its own. It's one sentence here, one sentence there, one sentence at the end. They don't make any coherent whole. So here's the suggestion. Suggestion is that the editor realized that if you have whole J passages and whole E passages, the reader will see the text as separate pieces. It won't read like a single text. It won't have any unity. It won't be integrated. Think literary criticism. So here's what he did. He changed a few names. I mean, you know, not so many. 10% here, 50% there. With passage, that passage. Changed a few names so the text won't be so blatantly various. Names of God he changed. The names of God in a fragment belonging to this group, and he puts the fragment in, and he puts it in so that they'll accept it. He changes a few of the names of God. Well, this editor seems now to have some sense of freedom to work with the text. So how come he left in the contradictions? If he feels enough freedom to change the names, to give it more unity, why didn't he do something about the contradictions to give it more unity? Answer, there were two editors. Two editors. Why be skimpy? Why be stingy? We can have two editors. One editor felt the freedom to change things, and the other editor was too biased to change things. The other one editor lumped everything together, and the other editor changed a few things. Ah, you'll ask me, why did the second editor only change names and not change the contradictions? That was his interest, you know, that's what appealed to him. That was his particular area of expertise, or maybe there were three editors, maybe things were changed back. You have a whole series of editors. They're all hypothetical, after all. So you can make them up as you like. Pretty soon you get to the point where whatever the text looks like, you could cook up another editor and explain it, because there's nothing to control your cooking. This now sounds like evolution. We'll do that in another case. But it gets to the point where it's very difficult to falsify this type of exercise, and in science, that's not supposed to be very good. Yeah.
Can someone just use the argument that contradictions are too difficult to find as opposed to combining all of the best names? In that case, it's more than just there was a knowledge going on to figure out the contradictions.
I mean, you can make up whatever you like, but of course, the way to solve a contradiction is not to solve it, but just to change one of the sentences so it isn't a direct contradiction. And a qualifier. He said that he couldn't do that. He could change the name, but he couldn't think of that. Maybe, I mean, the person whose mind's limited in that way, he can't do it. I don't think it's too difficult to do. It says 6 and 6, make this say 6 and 9, make this say 7. You know, it doesn't sound like it needs a great deal of genius to figure out how to do it, but okay. This one says 3, that one says 4. You know, change the dates. It's not the end of the world. Make solve a contradiction. I don't think it would be so difficult. But maybe you're right. Maybe. As long as you're making it up, sky's the limit. And there's nothing to control the sperm. Now, this hypothesis was first concocted in the 1880s by Dillon and Wellhausen in Germany. They had a whole school of literary criticism. It's quite interesting that he applied this method not only to the Bible, but he applied it to the Iliad and the Odyssey also, Greek classics, coming from an entirely different culture, an entirely different time period. It was a fashion in literary criticism. In the 30s and 40s, this fashion died in the Greek classics, but still lingering and limping on in the Jewish sector. And in particular, when he concocted it, the archaeology of the Near East was almost non-existent. Since then, however, archaeology has revealed some features which can call into question some of their assumptions. In particular, religious documents have been found where a god may have several names. It seems that that was a feature of Near Eastern mythology. You don't have one name per god. You don't have to have one name per god. That being the case, the fact that the biblical text has several names for God, unless you want to say that those other ancient texts also had several even older authors, there also were fragments, they also had an editor, but they don't do that. They're not willing to go that far. So the variation in names for God does not become such a terribly strong argument for variation in authorship. Let me just summarize. What am I doing now? Now I'm attacking the evidence, even in applying it, against single human authorship. Here it's relevant, but I think it's not very strong. All the arguments I'm giving you now about the lack of a single evidence for the single editor, about the fact that the editor would have had to change some things, leave other things together, about the variation in names in ancient documents, all of this is to show that even as against single human authorship, the evidence is not very strong. Here it's relevant, but I'm claiming it's not very strong. Then, about 20 years ago, there was a project carried out at the Technion in Haifa, which was published in 1985. The title of the book is Genesis and Authorship Study, where variations in literary style in the book of Genesis were analyzed by computer. These people were testing the hypothesis that the variations in style in the book of Genesis really justify assuming that it had more than one author. This is a study that was carried out in cooperation by people various places in the world. The head of the study wrote the Technion. And here's what they did. They identified features of literary style in Hebrew and in other languages. And they took chunks of text, the book of Genesis, and chunks of text of other authors of the same length as the book of Genesis, same number of words, and they programmed the computer to analyze the amount of variation in style that you found in each author. So, let's say you have three human authors, X, Y, and Z. You take a chunk of X's work the size of Genesis. Program the computer to analyze the variations in style of this chunk of X's work. How much variation is there? Do the same thing for Y. Do the same thing for Z. Then you test the program. Take a third of X, a third of Y, a third of Z, make it into a big chunk and analyze how much variation in style there is. The answer is that when you take chunks from different authors, the variation in style is gigantic. When you take chunks from a single author, we know who the author is. There are variations. People don't write the same thing all the time. In a chunk as large as Genesis, you know, you might throw in some poetry. And you might change subject from narrative to lists of items to laws. So there are going to be certain variations in style. Calculate it. Count it up. Now, what they found in the test cases is that the variations in style for single author were in a certain range. When you compare different authors, the variations were gigantically larger. There was no middle ground. So it means that in terms of giving an indicator of whether you have one author or different authors, the program worked pretty well for known cases. Then they applied the program to Genesis. Genesis had more literary consistency than any of the test cases. It means in terms of variations of style, Genesis is more likely to have a single author than any of the three cases where we know it's a single author. And therefore they said, if you are basing your hypothesis of multiple authorship on variations in style, you're making a mistake. Because here's a computer study which shows that we use the same criteria to get to the opposite conclusion. Now, the authors of this study, which can be purchased, I purchased it from Amazon. The authors of this study made two claims. One of which I think was only the sort of thing a computer scientist could say. And the other is very important and brilliant in itself. One thing they said was, this has been done by machine, every other study has been done by human beings, so this is better because machines are perfectly objective. That's pretty dumb, as you know, because after all, human beings have to program the computer, and in particular, human beings have to identify what the variations in style are and how to weigh them. And even if you say they're all equally important, that's a chosen weighing. Someone else might say the name of God is more important than the order of numbers, and therefore you shouldn't weigh them the same. Computers are not completely objective. Or rather, they use human judgment, which is not completely objective. One remark they did make, which I found to be quite brilliant, is this. Not all variations in style count. Only a variation in style of which the author is unaware counts. Why? Because if you presume the author is aware of the variation, then he might very well have had a reason for it. And even if I don't know what the reason is, it's safe to assume he had a reason, and therefore there's no reason to think there were two. So what you have to look for is some variation in style that's so natural, so easy, so obvious, so common, that the person uses it without thinking. Now, I think that's a brilliant remark. Just, to me, makes it very difficult to carry out, because how are you going to know what was unconscious variation style for an author 2,500 years ago in a culture quite different from yours. I think that's jumping quite far out on the limb of the tree. Now, what about the conclusion? I must tell you, having taught computer science, I have my reservations about jumping on the computer bandwagon. But I will say this. Here you have people, by the way, none of them is religious, so therefore you can trust them, they're objective, they're not trying to prove anything. Of course not. They don't love the cheeseburgers either. But if they were religious, you'd have to doubt. You think it's just propaganda. And here are people, by claiming to use the same methodology and arriving at an opposite conclusion. That, to me, means at least that the methodology is not all that solid. Now, it's very interesting. In the book, they have an appendix by a then very famous biblical scholar, Shmaiyahu Talmon. And he, you have to know how to read academics. This is published in 1985, right? He says, well, the use of the computer is a great breakthrough. It's wonderful to have these tools for our important discipline. And, of course, you do get not always the same results. In 1967, a computer study of the flood story was published. He came to the opposite conclusion. But then more research will be needed. Now, let's just pay attention. We're talking about 67 to 85 in computer science. Is that really a fair comparison? I don't think so. Computers got a lot better in 20 years from 67 to 85. Furthermore, the 67 study was done on one chapter, and the 85 study was done on the whole book. Does that really count as the fields being divided and hopelessly at odds and producing no conclusions? I wouldn't say so. And if that's the best he's got to object, that isn't much. And then he goes on to say that the results have to be studied and, indeed, have to be taken into account. Well, they should be taken into account at least to show that the whole project is not well-defined, and since it isn't well-defined, its conclusions should not be accepted as established. Now, one more point to make, and then I'll be glad to discuss these matters with you for a while anyway. In the study of texts, ancient texts, there is a phenomenon very widespread called anachronism. And here's how it works. Somebody's writing a book, creating a myth about the ancestors of his people. So he's writing a story at a particular time about what he imagines, mythologizes, happened 500 years before or 1,000 years before. He places the myth far in the past. And he writes about people and events that took place. How does he describe them? Let's say he's describing a war. What weapons does he describe? Let's suppose he describes people moving from place to place. What animals do they use? What routes do they use? What cities do they pass along the way? What neighbors do they have? Well, how does he know? He's making up a story now about something which was supposed to have happened 500 years ago. He doesn't know what happened 500 years ago. So typically what he does is he takes his own conditions and writes them into the story. If he now uses bows and arrows, and he writes about a war his ancestors had 500 years before, he has them shooting bows and arrows. If they now go through a trade route that passes points A, B, and C, when he describes people 500 years before, they also go past A, B, and C in his story, because that's what he knows. Now, archaeologists dig up the 500 years before. And what do they discover? There were no bows and arrows 500 years before. A, B, and C as cities didn't exist 500 years before. That's how they know it's an anachronism. It's an anachronism because the conditions of life that he puts into the story don't agree with the reality of the time he's telling the story about. That's called anachronism. Anachronism means projecting your conditions on the past. Are you with me? You find this very commonly in ancient mythology, for the reason that I described. They're writing it at a time, about a time long in the past, and they have no access to information about that time, So they make up the conditions using their own conditions, and those conditions are typically wrong. Now, when you apply that test to the book of Genesis, it flops. Because the conditions of life that are described in the stories of the patriarchs are indeed accurate to the time. So if you thought, as some people will tell you, like Finkelstein here in Israel and other minimalists in the archaeological school, that these stories were made up in the late Second Temple period or the Maccabean period, and they're all fiction, and they're being made up about times 1,000 years before, it would be very difficult to explain how they got fairly trivial details of existence right. Joseph is sold as a slave for 20 pieces of silver. That was the average price of a slave in his time, not before and not after. He didn't have world almanacs piled up, you know, for 1,000 years. So you can look by that. I'm writing this about 1,000 years ago. Let's get the almanac from, you know, 1800 BCE and look up the price of slaves. So we'll get it right. You know, it wasn't that kind of information society where you could do that. All the action takes place in the south of Israel, patriarchal stories. As a matter of fact, the Galilee was not settled at that time. Later, when the stories were supposed to have been written, the Galilee was settled. The question is, how would the author know that? Names that are used are names that are found at that time and not found in later sources. So, the conditions of life represent an accurate description, not an anachronism. Now, you could suppose, if you felt the need to, that this society, unlike other ancient societies, kept records of trivial information. It is played Trivial Pursuit as a kind of regular pastime, and they kept records of trivial information. Maybe some novelists will read it later. You could opine that. It's possible. We have no record of any such thing, of any society doing that, not even this society. Or you could say that God, who knew the truth of the period, dictated the stories to Moses. And that's how the information was preserved. But one thing's for sure, you can't use the same technique of anachronism to disprove the accuracy of the biblical, of the patriarchal narratives as you can for the myths of other nations. So, in this respect, it's a kind of indirect support. It's not going to be attacked in the way that other supposedly historical myths are attacked in other cultures. Okay. Let me leave it here for now and see if there are questions. Yeah.
I understand you said there's no opportunity for literary criticism to ever criticize or confirm the divinity of but you then use like computer study and the other studies to confirm this. The single authorship of the text is a possibility. Irrespective of that argument, even if it was a single author, it still can't refute.
Was that accurate? Pretty accurate. My conclusion from the computer study was that people using the same methodology have arrived at opposite conclusions.
But one of the conclusions could still be right. Within their framework. Right?
Well, I just... Yeah, but look... If people using the same methodology arrive at opposite conclusions, that should lead us to question the methodology. Something's fishy in Paris if people using the same method applied to the same material arrive at opposite conclusions. Either they don't understand the material the same way, they don't understand the method the same way, the application is not objective, something's gone wrong. Right? That's my conclusion. But you can't trust the whole discipline if people using the same methods arrive at opposite. Just imagine two mathematicians, one proves P and the other proves the opposite of P. What would you say about mathematics? You'd say I can't rely on the whole discipline.
My response is
you're looking at it from the question of what it was divine authorship. No, leave divine authorship out. Suppose we were all atheists. Suppose we're questioning now one human author or many human authors. Here's a group of people to say, we have strong evidence for many human authors using this method. Now I say, here's another group using the same method, coming out with the inclusion of one human author. So I say the question of how many human authors you had, your method is not very good. Correct, I'm criticizing the method.
But you're criticizing the field, you're not criticizing the method. But there are two methods within the field, right? And you're saying because those two methods come out with opposite conclusions, that's where the whole field is.
Well, they don't recognize it as two methods. They're both assessing variations in literary style. Why is it two different methods? One's a machine and one's human beings?
One is statistical, and one is more literary.
The statistical analysis is of literary variation. That's what they're analyzing. So, and even if it were two methods, if it were two methods and neither one could explain what's wrong with the other method, then the whole field still is in disarray. You have disagreement about what method to use in the same field, trying to assess the same hypothesis in the same text.
Okay, but irrespective of all this, it doesn't matter anyway, because if it was written by God, you would still figure it out anyway. So is there any non-religious methodology that can be applied to a religious text to it? I'm not saying what you even confirm it or support it.
Okay, see, that's, I'm glad you brought it up again. I'm talking about biblical criticism as it's done now. You're asking now about what could happen to the field if it was changed imaginatively and creatively. I have no idea. There's no way to predict what will happen to a field if it's changed, and I have no way to say. I would not rule out biblical criticism or related studies altogether as irrelevant to questions of divine authorship. All I can say is, as it's done so far, since all the arguments rest on human psychology, they have nothing to do with divine authorship. That's my argument. As long as you're resting your argument on human psychology, then it's got nothing to do with divine. If you're not going to rest it on human psychology, then maybe you could do something as well. I don't know. I can't foreclose a whole field. I can't say how a whole field will develop.
So like you said, there were texts found that had multiple names of in those texts. So conceivably, you could find things written on scrolls and from the same time period using the same grammar, using the same names, or using similar variations of names of the other text, right?
Yeah, but now you're talking about something else. Now you're talking about new evidence.
Sure.
I'm talking about the methodology applied to the old evidence. The door's open. I don't believe in closing any doors. I think that there's a lot of extremism that people express. It's all right or it's all wrong. I think we know far too little to say things like that. All I can say is that what we have is not doing the job. And just to respond to one other thing you sort of mentioned, the evidence that they have of single authorship is surely only evidence relevant to single human authorship, because it's a question of variations of style. The whole question of variations of style doesn't relate to the question of divine authorship. So it's an internal battle that has nothing to do with us. Just because it's an internal battle, I think it discredits the whole discipline.
Archaeology, you brought up a little bit. Yeah. Now, so could you use archaeology to prove the Bible or not?
It's very difficult. I'll tell you why. Because
how do they know the real Bible?
If you found an item from the period of King David,
how do they know the period? How do they calculate the years?
It's difficult. Everything's difficult. The whole field is difficult, and they put on a brave face and they say, we know this and that, but then if you just take a look at the literature, you say, for everyone who knows this, there's somebody who knows the opposite, and they're all very sure they're right. So it's a very difficult field in that respect. Plus, there are certain guidelines. Number one, finding something is infinitely more important than not finding something. Here's a rule that is honored more in the breach than in the acceptance. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Try that on precise. Absence of evidence. I didn't find anything. Nothing's there. I don't see anything. It's not evidence of absence. Since I didn't find something, there never was anything there. That doesn't follow. For three reasons. First of all, and by the way, if you have access to the internet, there's a wonderful website that I recommend to you, one from which I have learned a great deal, from a fellow named George Athas, A-T-H-A-S. He's one of the people doing the Tel Dan in the north of Israel. And he has extensive notes on the introductory course in archaeology that he gives there. One problem with archaeological discoveries, finds, proofs, evidence is this: that events don't always leave the kind of evidence you're looking for. You'll read, for example, that the War of the Four Kings and the Five Kings, there's no evidence for that war. And brave archaeologists will tell you, therefore we know there was no such war. Athos points out that everyone agrees that Babylon was conquered. There is no archaeological evidence for the conquest of Babylon. None. The city was not burned. It was not destroyed. The walls weren't crushed. There's no archaeological evidence for the conquest of Babylon. Nor is there any archaeological evidence for the conquest of England by William the Conqueror in 1066. No one doubts that William the Conqueror conquered England in 1066. There's no archaeological evidence for it. How could there be a war without archaeological evidence? Here's a simple scenario. Two armies fight it out on the battlefield. One army wins a decisive victory, and the other army accepts defeat and surrenders. No cities are burned, no walls are destroyed, no plunder, no looting, just taxation and occupation. What do you expect to find 1,000 years later? What are you going to dig up? You're not going to find anything. You're going to find the one battlefield? Probably not. At any rate, here are two wars which all historians agree happened, but which is no archaeological evidence whatsoever. So why then should you assume that because you haven't found evidence for this war, it didn't happen? Indeed, in the Torah, the only description of a battlefield is in the Dead Sea area. I don't think any digs have been done there. That'll go down 3,000 years to try to find the remains of a war that took place, a battle that took place in that area. So you have to be very careful, number one, when they claim that they have searched and haven't found, is this the kind of thing which must have left behind evidence? Number two, have they looked in the right places? Athos estimates that of all the material relevant to the biblical period in the land of Israel, approximately 15% has been uncovered. 85% has not been uncovered. He said, well, I haven't found it. Okay, because you haven't found 85% of the material. No, maybe you're just not looking at exactly the right place, you haven't dug deeply enough, or as he said, you haven't dated the strata correctly, in which case you haven't found it, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. And then there's the problem of interpretation, which is rife in archaeology. Kathleen Kenyon was a great British archaeologist. One of her most famous excavations was of the city of Jericho, which she did over a multi-year period. And she dated it at 100 to 150 years, the fall of Jericho, and 100 to 150 years before the entry of the Jewish people into the land of Israel. Which means, of course, that Joshua did not fit the battle of Jericho, and he did not conquer the city. Sorry?
Isn't it just easy to say that he miscalculated?
Well, you know, it's easy to say anything, but it's harder to have reason for what you say. I'll give you some reason in a minute. That's why I'm pointing it out. Talk is much too cheap. Everywhere. It's always worthwhile when someone says something to ask them what his reason is for saying it. Leads to interesting results often. Awkward silences, staring at the ceiling, things like that. She said the Battle of Jericho, which is recorded in the book of Joshua, was obviously a myth that the Jews made up later to glorify their ancestors, because when they came into the land, they already found Jericho destroyed. Now, how did she date the fall of Jericho? She used pottery. And in particular, that pottery is considered to be the most accurate dating method archaeology in organized human societies. And what she found was this. There's a certain type of imported Cypriot pottery And they can date, they say, more or less, when that pottery came into the land of Israel, the whole area. And she found none of it in Jericho. So she says, Jericho must have fallen before the entry of that pottery into the land of Israel. And that's how she dated the fall of Jericho. Now, in an article in Biblical Archaeological Review, several critical remarks are addressed to this theory. Number one, she sunk two shafts down into the city in her day, and she herself describes them as into the poor section of the city. If you're looking for imported pottery, is that where you would look? In the poor section of the city? She herself says that Jericho at that time was not on any of the major trade routes. Is that where you would look for imported pottery? She ignored the local pottery on the grounds that a fellow named Garstang in the 30s did a terrible job of classifying it and organizing it. Just confused the whole picture. So she just ignored it and based her argument on the lack of imported pottery. The later people have looked at the local pottery and have come up with a later date for the conquest of Jericho. So if that's the basis of her claim and that's the way in which it could be criticized, I don't think we have to roll over and play dead. She's interpreting, and she's interpreting absence of evidence and interpreting it on fairly weak grounds, and that is her conclusion for it being a myth. So you have to be very careful. I'm sorry to keep you late, but one more remark, then I'm really going to quit. Some people ask why there is not external confirmation of the events that the Torah describes. Exodus from Egypt, the plagues, crossing of the sea. Why don't Egyptian records mention those events? Well, here you have to know, even secular historians agree that ancient historical records were written to glorify the powers that be. Who wrote the records? Scribes. Who paid the scribes? The king paid the scribes. So they never wrote anything embarrassing to the people who were paying them. No ancient records contain records of defeats. The only ancient text which contains records of its own defeats is the Torah. Here's an example. Sancheriv wrote his memoirs. Sancheriv conquered the whole area. Here's what he writes. He had a style. And for each city that he came to, this is what he writes. I surrounded the city, I broke through the walls, I conquered the army, I looted the city, slaughtered the population. City after city after city. Then he comes to Jerusalem. He writes, I surrounded the city, I locked up the king of Judah like a bird in a cage. End of entry. On to the next city. What happened? What happened to breaking down the walls? What happened to defeating the army? What happened to looting the city? Well, you see, the Torah says that his whole army died in one night. So he didn't break down the walls. He didn't defeat the army. He didn't loot the city. Didn't happen. He doesn't write that part. Why should he write in his memoirs that he lost an army? You know, that's embarrassing. He surrounded him. That was an achievement. So he writes that in. The rest of it just leaves out. So the fact that the Exodus is not mentioned by the Egyptians is what you would perfectly well expect. You don't expect the Egyptians to write records of their own defeats. No ancient people did that. The first ones to start writing what we would call history were the Greeks. But that's 1,000 years later. Okay. I'm going to take my left of the stairs. I'm going to go to the front of the